With that, the ashes settled and shushed. My arm lifted light as a feather and pounded the door knocker. A giant guard opened up.
"What do you want?"
he growled. He looked like he had been fashioned by setting boulders atop boulders. His hands were iron mallets, and his face rough carved out of granite. He was a mountain clothed in a lobster back uniform.
"'Another do-gooder,' he grunted,
when I explained my mission. He lifted the corner of the rag that covered my bucket and sniffed.
"'You got any fink taster in there?'
"'Scrap, sir. The mistress normally feeds them to the pigs, but she's a good soul and told me to bring them for the prisoners,' I lied. He grunted, peered into the bucket, and poked through it with a finger.
"'Rice pudding?'
"'Yes, sir.' The guard crossed the room, took a bowl down from the shelf, and used a spoon to dish the rice pudding from the bucket.
"'And you're kin to this boy you seek?'
he asked. "'My older brother, sir,' I lied. "'Always was a stubborn cuss. Made Mama cry herself to sleep at night.
"'Why ain't your mother here, then?'
"'She's dead, sir.' That much was true. The guard was more interested in rice pudding than my patchwork story. He shoveled several spoonfuls in his mouth and chewed while looking me over.
"'Come on, then,'
he said, taking a ring of keys from a hook on the wall.
"'I'll give you a little time.'
The sound of his key turning in the lock brought back my time in the city hall dungeon with the madwoman and the rats. Despite the cold, a trickle of sweat inched down my backbone. We walked down a hall lined with four doors on each side, and at the end, a staircase. He stopped at the last door on the right and unlocked it.
"'Here we go,'
he said. The cell was little bigger than the one I had been confined in. It was filled with men and boys milling around like nervous cattle herded into a goat pen. There was no fire burning, nay, not even a hearth where it could burn. A short man dressed in black peered out of the cell's one window stuck in the middle of the outside wall. The man's collar was flipped up to protect his neck. His hat was pulled down, and his hands were stuck in his armpits for warmth. The window had bars across it, but no glass. It was an empty hole, open to the rain, wind, and snow. All turned to stare as we entered.
"'Girl come to see her brother,'
the guard said. "'Excuse me, sir,' I said as he started to close the door. "'What about my bucket?' He smiled.
"'Needs further inspection.'
No one said anything, nor moved until the guard finished relocking the door and his footsteps echoed down the hall.
"'You'll be wanting him in the corner,' said the short man by the window. "'Show her.'
A few of the prisoners stepped to the side so I could see a bundle of rags on the floor. Corzin was lying on the stones with no blankets covering him, nor a pallet under him, not even straw. His leg was still wrapped in the bloody bandage. His lips were dry and cracked. He clutched his hat in one hand. I crouched next to him, unsure what to do. The soldiers around us grew tired of staring and returned to their low conversating. I leaned close to figure if he was breathing. Finally, I put my lips to his ear. "Are you dead?" I whispered. He answered without moving. "No country. Are you?"
I near jumped out of my skin. "Corzin?"
His eyes opened slow, bloodshot and bleary.
"Can you sit up?"
I asked.
"Suppose so."
I helped pull him upright. He winced and leaned against the wall, shaking with chills. "Here." I untied my heavy cloak and laid it over him. He protested.
"You don't have to,"
I interrupted him.
"Hush. Did you get shot?"
He pulled the cloak up under his chin and shivered again.
"In the leg. My luck held, though. Bullet went in and out fair clean. Didn't break the bone."
He stopped as a man nearby broke into a fit of coughing. I sat next to him.
"Was it awful?"
I asked. He closed his eyes and shook his head.
"You don't want to know."
"Yes, I do."
"When the redcoats invaded,"
he started.
"We raced up the island to the fort. Figured we'd hold there for months, then drive them from the city come spring when our forces would be stronger."
"Ha!" spat the man closest to us. He rolled over to face the wall.
Did you shoot a gun? I asked. Mostly dug ditches and carried rocks. The soldiers, they worked alongside us, and they drilled to get ready. When the battle finally started, the men fired their guns so fast the barrels grew hot. The cannon smoke was thick as fog. I saw the most horrid sights, country, not fit for the eyes of any person. He swallowed hard. I wound up next to a militia boy from Connecticut. He'd just learned to shave and was a poor hand at it. Razor cuts all over his chin. Said he was worried his pa was mad at him on account of he didn't make it home for the apple harvest like he promised. He fell silent for a moment, then continued. So this boy, he had two muskets, one his own, the other from a fellow who died on Long Island. When the Hessians came at us, the boy would shoot one gun whilst I reloaded the other. We continued thus, loading and shooting, loading and shooting half the day. The British moved their small cannons up the hill and took aim, but I loaded. He shot. He paused to wipe his eyes on his sleeve. As I handed him his gun, a cannonball ripped his head from his body. We sat without a word. The ashes within me swirled and filled up my throat again. Around us, men muttered low and coughed. Corzine let his tears run. After that, I shot the guns for myself. Took the bullet in my leg, but kept firing. An hour or so later, Colonel McGough surrendered the fort. We laid down our weapons and walked out. The British called for our officers to walk forward, and we feared they'd be shot. Were they? I asked. Not hardly. He sat up a little straighter. Officers get special treatment on account of they're considered gentlemen. They have parole to walk around the city. They live in boarding houses and eat regular. The man who faced the wall muttered a string of curses that echoed against the stones. He said every kind of bad word imaginable about officers, gentlemen, the war, the British, and the Congress, and he cursed himself for leaving his wife and farm in Maryland. Corzine's tears dried, leaving a thin trail of salt on his cheeks. You should go home now. Before I could ask one of 100 questions, the key turned in the lock and the guard appeared. He stuck out my bucket. Inspection complete, he said, wiping a smear of butter off the side of his face. I stood, walked to the door, and looked in the bucket. Half of the food was gone. May I stay a while longer? I asked. Sing out when you need me, the guard said with an unsettling wink. As soon as the door was relocked, a man with powder burns on his face snatched the bucket from my hands. I'll take that, he snarled. I held tight to the handle and shouted, give it back! The man grabbed my arm, his fingers like the claws of a panther.
Enough!
Shouted a powerful voice. The cell fell silent as a tomb. The short man, dressed in black, limped over to us from his post by the window.
Release that bucket, Private Dibden, he ordered.
The thief did as he was asked, but crossed his arms over his chest and stood his ground.
She brought food for the black boy, Sergeant, he complained. Tain't right for the slave to eat while we starve.
The tiny sergeant stood motionless. Somewhere water was dripping.
No one here will starve long as I have breath, he turned to me. Excuse the poor manners, miss, but we've not eaten for 3 days. Hungry men are sometimes rude.
I understand, I said.
Would you be willing to share what you brought? He asked. We would all be most grateful.
I looked the sergeant in the eye. He wasn't much taller than me. There's not enough to feed everyone.
I know that, miss, but we're all equal hungry.
Don't fuss, country, Corzine asked. We fought together. We'll eat together. Outside, a heavy cart rolled down Broadway, the driver calling to his horses. There was an argument from the cell on the other side of the wall and a thump from the one above. I handed the bucket to Corzine. The nasty man dug his claws into my shoulder.
The sergeant goes first,
I waited for him to release me, fighting the urge to bite his wrist down to the bone. Once he let go, I gave the bucket to the sergeant. He looked inside and pulled out a piece of pie crust the length of my finger. He handed the bucket to Corzine, who removed a long parsnip peel. The bucket made its way round the room at a snail's pace as each man studied the contents and chose a small portion of discarded potato or bread or gristle. When it was returned to me, I was confuddled. "There's still food in here," I said. "These are fine men," the sergeant said with pride. "Each took his portion without stealing from the next. Mind if we send it round again?" "No, sir." As the bucket went down the line again, the sergeant motioned for me to stand with him close to the wall. "I wonder if I might ask a favor." "What kind of favor?" I asked. "We need to pass messages on to our captain. He'll be able to get word out of the city. Some of the other women folk who bring food to the prisoners are helping in this manner."
"I can't spy for you."
"Oh, no, not a spy. Simply a message carrier. You come by here, I drop a word or two in your ear, and you pass it along."
"It will put me in danger."
"It's a way for you to continue our fight for freedom."
The bucket was moving more quickly the second time around.
"I cannot, sir."
I was not fool enough to let the Patriots hurt me again. The key sounded in the lock as the bucket returned to my hands, wiped empty this time. The guard entered. Corzine struggled to his feet and handed me my cloak.
"Here."
"No," I said, "you keep it."
"As soon as I fell asleep, it would be borrowed. Little sister, bring it the next time you come."
I wrapped the warm cloak around my shoulders and was struck with a sudden notion. I pulled the newspaper out from my cap and quickly removed the pages lining my shoes.
"Can you use this?"
"Hurry up," said the guard.
Corzine smiled.
"Just what I need for a bed," he said. "Go on home now."
I nodded, grateful to be leaving and heavy with guilt.
"You'll be here when I return."
"Don't plan on leaving any time soon," he said.
Chapter 36. Tuesday, December 3rd through Friday, December 13th, 1776. Our private soldiers in your hands are treated in a manner shocking to humanity, and that many of them must have perished through hunger, had it not been for the charitable contributions of the inhabitants. General George Washington complaining to British General William Howe. Lady Seymour was struck by a fever whilst visiting up in Greenwich. She had to be carried to her chamber, her skin the color of an old beeswax candle. Dr. Destouge came to bleed her so that her bodily humors would go back into balance. When the bleeding was over, Madam saw the doctor to the door. I was dusting the grandfather clock in the front hall.
"Good sir," Madam said in a low voice, "I wonder. I believe our aunt would recover faster at our estate in Charleston. She could sit in the sun for hours and breathe the healthful air. Don't you agree?"
The doctor's bushy eyebrows flew up in alarm.
"South Carolina is hundreds of miles from here, over bad roads. Lady Seymour would be dead by Philadelphia."
Which was likely Madam's intention, I thought. The doctor pulled on his gloves and picked up his bag.
"I doubt you'll be well enough to travel until spring. I will call again tomorrow."
He tipped his hat.
"Good day, madam."
Lady Seymour's bell rang upstairs as the door closed behind him. Madam squeezed her lips together so tight I thought she had bit them off.
"Girl," she spat, "go see what she wants."
By supper, it had been decided that I would tend Lady Seymour while she was bedridden. The master used his connections in the British High Command to secure extra firewood for the house, declaring that his aunt's bedchamber be kept as warm as the month of June. The heat of the room helped to bake out the fever in Lady Seymour's blood and ease her cough. 'Twas warm enough that I could go about in stocking feet, which was a comfort, for my shoes had taken to pinching my toes something wicked. As she recovered, the lady took to reading all of the newspapers printed in the city. Whenever she dropped off to sleep, I would steal as many sentences as I could.
Thusly, I followed the progress of the war, what was left of it. The flame of independence was sputtering and expected to burn out any day. The rebels had run out of ammunition, soldiers, and money. Mayor Matthews, him who plotted to kill General Washington, escaped from the rebel prison and returned to New York in triumph. The American Congress, frightened by the marching British, fled Philadelphia and ran to Baltimore. Newport, in my home state of Rhode Island, fell to the British, too. When I read that last bit of news, I was stunned. I had not spared a thought for Rhode Island for months. 'Twas several days before I could again sneak up to the Bridewell, toting sausages, crust, and cheese rinds. The guard stole a few of the sausages and gave me only a few moments to conversate. It mattered not. Corzine was not feeling up to much talk. I sat on the stone floor and checked the hole in his leg. It was hot, but free of yellow pus. Conditions in the prison had eased some. Folk in town had donated enough blankets that there was one to be shared between every two or three men. The British promised each prisoner would receive 2 pounds of pork and hardtack biscuit every week. They did not announce that the pork was often spoiled, nor that the men had to eat it raw, for there was no fire to cook it over. For my next visit, I saved my own helping of mince pie. I filled the bucket with potato scraps and mutton fat and put the pie on top. The guard took the pie, as I had hoped. "I loves a good mince pie," he said as he unlocked the door to the prison, pie crumbs spilling from his mouth. Frozen bodies were stacked in the hall, waiting to be buried in the pits. The clothes had been taken from the bodies to keep the living soldiers warmer. I kept my eyes on the ground out of modesty. Corzine was still not in the mood for conversating, not even a little bit. I thought he looked feverish, but when I went to feel his forehead, he pushed my hand away. The men snickered at that. I took my empty bucket and left. Snow fell all that night. Lady Seymour prepared an errand list for me the next afternoon. She had spent the morning gazing into the fire and had not taken any food. I made bold and suggested that she eat a biscuit with honey for her own good. "You need strength to get through the winter," I added. She set down her pen, picked up her teacup, and sipped the hot cinnamon water. "I thought it pleased you when I left so much on my plate." "Ma'am?" "The more I leave behind, the more there is for you to take to the prison." She studied me so close I thought she could see my thoughts. "That is where you've been taking the table scraps, isn't it?" My head bobbed once like a puppet's. "Am I to assume you know someone confined there?" I found my voice. "Yes, ma'am." She sipped again and looked at me over the rim of her teacup. "It is honorable to help a friend in need." "How did you know?" I blurted out. She folded the sheet of paper on the table. "These are the items I would like you to fetch for me. Purchase the ink and newspaper at Rivington's, but not the books. He overcharges. Go to that shop near the baker on Hanover Square. Elihu said they haven't closed." I bobbed once and took the paper. "Please, ma'am," I tried again. "How did you know?" Her gaze returned to the logs in the hearth. "Take care how you go, Isabel. Many people think it is a fine and Christian thing to help the prisoners. I do not think my niece is one of them." "Yes, ma'am," I whispered. It started to snow whilst I was in Rivington's. The wind blew the snow direct into my face as I crossed the square, and I was grateful to step into the shelter of the stationer's store, for 'twas warm and dry inside, near peaceful, if such a word can be used to describe a shop. A jelly-belly officer with thick spectacles was purchasing a tall stack of books from the man behind the counter. They were deep in their talk and appeared not to notice me. I took a slow turn around the shop, admiring the shelves, heavy with books, business forms, proclamations from Parliament and General Howe, slates, thick paper, quills, and sealing wax. The books called to me. My fingers itched to touch them. It had been months since I dug into the story of Robinson Crusoe. I glanced toward the counter. The men were arguing friendly-like about a fellow named Hume. They both had their faces planted in the same pamphlet. When I tried on a squeaky board, they did not even look up. I reached up to a bookshelf and flipped my way through the books, standing at attention. The titles were near as long as books themselves. Treatise on the Propagation of Sheep, the Manufacture of Wool, and the Cultivation and Manufacture of Flax, by John Wiley. Or Cato Major, or His Discourse of Old Age, with Explanatory Notes, by M.T. Cicero. Or Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral, by Phyllis Wheatley. And countless tracts containing sermons and advice. My fingers backed up. Mama told me about Miss Wheatley. She was kidnapped in Africa, sold in Boston, and wrote fancy poetry that smart people liked. She had visited London in England. She had been an enslaved girl, but was a free woman. I took the slim book off the shelf and opened the cover. I had never read a poem. What if I lacked the skill? What if I were caught? Might as well throw myself in the river. Bang! The closing door startled me so I near dropped the volume. I quickly set it back on the shelf and approached the counter. "Can I help you?" asked the young man who stood behind it. "Yes, sir," I handed him the list, "from the Lady Seymour. I hear she's been poorly," he said as he looked over the list. "Yes, sir, but she is strong enough to sit by the fire now and has a powerful urge to read." He nodded. "She's a good customer. I am glad she's on the mend." He quickly assembled everything on the list. The Letters of Lady Mary Wortley Montague, History of the Roman Republic, Volume 1, and the Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, and pulled out a large sheet of paper to wrap them in. As he worked the scissors, he paused. "You knew that boy, didn't you?"
"Pardon me?"
he continued cutting.
"Bellingham's boy, red hat, quick talker."
He creased the paper with his finger.
"He brought you here once in May, pointed to you out the window, convinced me to hand over 2 fresh-baked rolls, told me you would like to die from hunger if I didn't help."
He smiled at the memory.
"I'm sorry, sir," I said. "I didn't mean to take your food."
He pulled off a length of twine.
"You didn't. One of the advantages of courting the baker's daughter is all the bread a man can eat."
He had not yet commented on my looking at the books. I feared he might try and trip me up, get me to say something I ought not, but saw no other choice than to be polite. "I hope your lady is well, sir," I said. He concentrated on tying a bow.
"So do I. She fled with her father to a village in Pennsylvania, a place called Hatboro. They make hats there. Clever, don't you think?"
He tried to smile, but his eyes were downcast and melancholy.
"Perhaps 'tis safer there," I said.
"Aye," he said, finishing the bow, "with plenty of young men eager to protect her. But that's a tale for another day." He kept the package in his hands, lost in thought.
"Master Lockton will settle his aunt's account at the end of the week," I said. "Oh, aye."
He gave me the package and waited as I settled it in my basket.
"I hear tell you're one of them who feeds the lads in the bride well."
A sizzling log in the hearth popped suddenly, and I jumped.
"Not me, sir."
"Begging pardon, but someone is mistaken." He crossed his arms over his chest and shook his head.
"That there mark on your face makes you hard to forget, lass."
The heat from the hearth filled the room and made it hard to breathe. My eyes darted to the windows and I fought the urge to run. It felt like all of New York was watching me. He leaned forward, put his elbows on the counter, and lowered his voice, though we were the only people in the shop. "You tell them boys in jail to hang on. There's plenty of us out here trying to help."
"Sir?"
He removed a slim volume from under the counter.
"This is for you. Don't let your mistress see it."
"I cannot read, sir," I lied. He snorted once as he quickly wrapped the book.
"Of course you can't."
He pushed the package to my side of the counter. "All who love liberty should commit the words to heart."
"I can't take it," I started. "I cannot pay. I only have a few left, and those I should burn,"
he said with a wave of his hand.
"Read it, pass it on, and keep feeding the lads."
I bobbed once and hid the parcel in my pocket under my apron. As soon as I could stand close enough to a fire, I'd get rid of it. The last thing I needed was more trouble on account of independence.
"Yes, sir," I said, hurrying for the door. "Thank you, sir."
He raised his finger to his lips in a last warning.
Shh.
Chapter 37. Saturday, December 14th through Monday, December 23rd, 1776. The distress of the prisoners cannot be communicated in words. 20 or 30 die every day. They lie in heaps unburied. What numbers of my countrymen have died by cold and hunger, perished for want of the common necessaries of life? I have seen it. This, sir, is the boasted British clemency. Letter written from New York describing prisoners captured at Fort Washington. Lady Seymour regained her strength by the day. I was no longer allowed to spend warm hours in her bedchamber. She took her breakfast and dinner alone, but joined the rest of the company for supper each night. Madam was saddened by her husband's aunt's return to health. The next week passed in a kitchen storm of flour and sugar, for Christmas was fast approaching. Madam's list of required delicacies was endless. Gingerbread, pies of brandy peaches and preserved cherries and mincemeat, macaroons, blancmange, Jordan almonds, sugar candy, as many kinds of cake as there were fingers on both hands. I was the dog's body in charge of keeping the oven stoked with wood and the ashes cleared out, fetching forgotten ingredients from the market, and beating eggs 10 at a time till my arm was near to fall off. Two of the soldier wives got into a terrible squabble the day the woodpile froze. Hannah told Mary it was her turn to fetch home the buckets from the tea water pump, and Mary said no, 'twas Hannah's turn. Back and forth they went, the words getting hotter as their tempers grew shorter. "I went yesterday," Mary said loudly as she poured boiling water into a basin. "You know that for a fact because you told me my nose was the color of a cherry when I came in." Hannah shook her head as she scrubbed the floor. "No, no, no, that was 2 days ago. Yesterday I slipped on the ice and fell on my backside. Near broke my tailbone, I did. Could barely come up the steps this morning." "You're a lying cod face, you are," Mary said. Hannah threw the brush in the bucket and water splashed on the floor. "Who you calling a liar?" Sarah, the boss lady, came through the door just as Mary rounded the table, her hands balled up into fists. Sarah was getting close to her time and had a bit of a temper herself. She slammed the door so hard the whole house shook. "Shut your gobs," she shouted. "I'll report the pair of you to the colonel if you don't straighten up. There'll be no more brawling or caterwauling in this kitchen." "But," they both said. Sarah leveled such a glare at the pair of them, I thought their hair would catch fire, and I suddenly saw a way clear to my own purposes. "Begging pardon, Miss Sarah, ma'am," I said meekly. "What do you want?" she said, her eyes still on the other women. "I can fetch the tea water," I volunteered. Mary shook her head back and forth. "Oh, no, she won't. She'll tarry at the shops to get out of her own chores. Make one of them men do it, I say." "I'm the first one awake to build up the fires," I explained. "The shops are still closed then. I'll dash up to the pump and be back before the sun comes up." Sarah gave me a suspicious look. "Why would you take on extra work, special with it being so cold and dark in the morning?" "I was raised in the country, miss. Too much time inside makes me feel poorly. I like walking in the fresh air, even if it is cold." 'Twas mostly a lie, but the tea water pump was right close to the prison. Fetching water would give me a chance to check on Corson every day. Hannah picked up her scrub brush and knelt on the floor again. "Let her go, I say. Saves us the trouble of freezing our tails off." She dipped the brush in the bucket. "Don't know what possessed me to follow my Jimmy to this godforsaken colony." The next morning found me headed up island long before the sun rose. When I knocked on the guardhouse door of the prison, it was opened by a soldier I'd never seen before, a short man with black hair, sky-blue eyes, and a scowl. "You can't come in," he said after I explained my errand. "Regulations been changed." "Tell her about the windows," called another soldier, warming himself by the fire. "The regulations permit civilians to deliver food and sundry provisions, but not firewood," added the man at the hearth, yawning. "But not firewood," repeated the first man. "There will be regular patrols round the perimeter of the building to ensure that civilians do not tarry overlong in conversation with the prisoners. And we'll be checking on the grub you give them," said his companion. "Guards will inspect all civilian donations," the first man said formally.
If you deliver contraband items, you will be imprisoned yourself.
I shivered once. Are scones and jam contraband?
Not yet.
Back outside, I walked around the front of the building, trying to figure where Corzine's cell lay. Some prisoners were already awake, their hands and arms wrapped in rags sticking through the bars of the window. Corzine's cell lay to the back of the building. I rounded the corner and stopped. This was where the burial pits were dug. The pits were just a little smaller than the cells, dug down the height of a grown man. One of them had already been filled with bodies and covered again with dark mud. Two lay open and empty, sprinkled with snow like sugar on a cake. I did not know how many bodies would fit in each. I shivered again and pulled my cloak tight, then turned my back to the graves and counted the windows. 2, 3, 4, until I came to the window I hoped led to Corzine's cell. The eastern sky had brightened enough for me to see all around, but the inside of the prison was dark. I stepped up to the building. The bottom of the window was just above the top of my head. I stood on tiptoe and stretched my hands up to the bars. "Hello," I called in a hushed voice. "Corzine? Anyone?" The nasty fellow who had tried to steal my bucket on my first visit, Dibden, leaned his face against the bars. He had a blanket around his shoulders and Corzine's hat up on his head.
"Won't let you in no more, eh?"
"They changed the rules. Can you fetch my brother, please, sir?"
"He's sleeping."
I wanted to pull the bars apart, snatch the hat from his head, and thrash him with my fist and shoes, but that was impossible. I forced honey into my voice in a humble tone. "Well, then, may I please speak to your sergeant?"
"Sergeant's dead." He turned his head and spat. "I'm in charge now. I'll take the victuals you brought."
I started to reach into the bucket to hand the scones through the bars, but stopped. "How do I know my brother's not dead, too? Wake him up, please."
Dibden opened his mouth but closed it without a word. His hunger was stronger than his temper, it seemed. He turned to someone in the cell. "Get the black boy over here."
A moment later, Corzine appeared at the window. He was shaking so badly he could barely stand, his eyes half closed, teeth chattering. He had no blanket around him, and there were puke stains on the front of his shirt. His gold earring was missing, too.
"Corzine, Corzine," I hissed. "What ails you? What can I do?"
He did not hear me, or could not. He was insensible of his own name and where he was.
Dibden joined Corzine at the window. "Terrible, ain't it? How fevers and pox tear through this place."
There was hollow laughter in the cell.
"Give him his hat back," I said, "and a blanket. Is he getting his rations?"
He did not answer me. That was an answer in itself. The prison was not a place of shared hardship anymore. It was a hole of desperation.
"You bloody beast," I swore. "How dare you let him starve?"
The words flew out of my mouth without pause.
"Who are you to reprimand me, girl?"
he snarled, putting his face up to the bars. His breath stank of rotting teeth and snot pulled at the edge of his nostrils.
"He's a slave. He will not be treated the same as free men."
He wiped his nose with the back of his hand.
"But you can remedy that," he said, "with ease."
I tried to keep my voice steady.
"How so?"
Corzine was seized by a fit of coughing so violent I feared his ribs would crack. He choked on his spittle and fought for breath, then finally relaxed back into his stupor, leaning against the window. Dibden glanced back at the other men in the cell before continuing.
"Our Captain Morse is on parole, lodged at the Golden Hill Tavern, we hear. Go there. Tell him the men have fever and pox. One of our lads, Bridgebane, has a father in Piscataway with money and influence. If the captain can get word to him, Bridgebane's father could arrange for a proper physician to attend us here."
Corzine coughed again and moaned. Sweat glistened on his forehead. "And the doctor would see to my brother," I said. Dibden hesitated, then gave a nod.
"Aye."
"And he gets a blanket and food." Dibden said something to a man I couldn't see. A blanket appeared on Corzine's shoulders. Corzine clutched it around himself. "And his hat." My voice was ice. Dibdin removed the hat and placed it on Corzine's head.
Lay him down, he instructed. On the rushes, not the bare floor.
Someone helped Corzine away from the window. I had no choice. I handed the jam-covered burnt scones up to the window. Dibdin stuck the first one in his mouth and passed the others to the men who suddenly crowded the window.
If he dies, you'll not see me again, I warned.
Understood, he said.
I found Captain Morse carrying out rubbish for the tavern keeper. He was a well-fed man wearing the brown coat trimmed with white that signified he was a prisoner of war. There was a big gap between his front teeth, but they looked clean enough. He joined me in the shadows of the alley and listened as I quickly explained my mission.
I'll try to get word to Bridgebane's family tonight. It is against all the laws of wars to treat prisoners so badly.
He paced angrily.
How often can you stop here?
Every morning.
Good. Tell Dibdin I'll see what I can do to ease their suffering, though I fear it will not be enough.
My brother is amongst the prisoners, I said. He's ill. Can you?
Can I see to it that he is given his share of whatever Bridgebane provides? I surely will. Your brother was calm and brave during the final battle. He's a true soldier.
The crow of a rooster interrupted him. The sun was fighting through the leaden clouds. I picked up the buckets. I have to hurry. He nodded.
Thank you for your help. My apologies, but I do not know your name.
I am called Sal.
Do you carry a last name as well, Sal?
I hesitated. According to Madam, my surname was Lockton, but it tasted foul in my mouth. I shook my head. He smiled.
Just Sal, then. Good day to you, just Sal.
Lucky for me, the overcast morn caused the other servants to sleep past their normal time. By the time Hannah and Mary staggered up from the cellar, I had the porridge bubbling and the tea steeping. I could not eat nor drink a thing, for my belly was tied up with fear. My thoughts chased round and round my brain pan. I could not visit the prison daily. I was sure to be caught and punished. But I had to visit the prison daily. Corzine's life depended on it. But someone would see me and was sure to remember the mark on my face. Word would get back to Madam, and she would tell Colonel Hawkins, and he would set someone to follow me, and Captain Morse would be flogged for passing on messages, and the prisoners in Corzine's cell would all be hung and buried in the pit. When I thought what they might do to me, I ran to the necessary and had me a good puking. But the next day, I made my way up there again. Food for the prisoners, water for the Locktons, and every once in a while, a message to the gap-toothed man in the brown coat at the Golden Hill Tavern. A few nights later, there was a terrible hullabaloo between Madam and the master when he announced at supper that he was planning to travel on the next ship to London. He would carry messages to Parliament, conduct his own business, and likely return to New York by the summer. Madam was not pleased. First, she argued that he ought not go. Then she argued, yes, he should go, and he should take her with him. When he refused, she threw a goblet in the fireplace and carried on so loudly that the master and Colonel Hawkins finally called for the carriage and left for a tavern. Madam dosed herself with strong wine after that and went to bed. That night, the temperatures fell so far below freezing that the biggest fire could not keep away the chill. I moved my pallet as close to the hearth as I dared and sat with all my clothes, my cloak and my blanket wrapped around me. 'Twas so cold I could not sleep. General Washington and his men were holed up in Morristown. Folks said they were in desperate need of stockings and food. I could scarce credit how hungry men with frozen feet could win a war. They were fools to even try. I waited as the clock first chimed 11 times, then 12, watching the firelight and trying not to ponder. When I got up to add wood to the fire, my feet wandered themselves to the pantry, and my hands pulled the loose boards there. Under the board were some sheets of newsprint I had saved, the lead piece from the statue of King George, my seeds, and the book given me by the stationer. I carried the book to my warm pallet and quietly untied the twine and removed the paper wrapping. I opened the cover. A fellow named Thomas Paine wrote the little book. He called it Common Sense. Mama always said that common sense was far from common. That's why it was so special when you found it. The first sentence in the book did not seem to contain any. Some writers have so confounded society with government as to leave little or no distinction between them, whereas they are not only different, but have different origins. Society is produced by our wants, and government by our wickedness. It took 4 readings to figure out the meaning, which I took to be that the life of folks is different than the world what rules over them. Payne sure did dance a long time with the notion before he said it. I closed the book and longed for Robinson Crusoe, still stranded in the study where Colonel Hawkins was asleep. I dared not rescue him. I opened the book again and attacked the next sentence. Chapter 38, Tuesday, December 24th through Wednesday, December 25th, 1776. Christmas is come, hang on the pot, let spits turn round and ovens be hot. Beef, pork, and poultry now provide to feast thy neighbors at this tide. Then wash all down with good wine and beer, and so with mirth conclude the year. Royal Virginia Almanac. I spent the day before Christmas fighting a holly bush with a pair of scissors. Madam required us twigs and berries for her decorating schemes. My morning dash to the prison, pump, and tavern had gone wonderful fast. There were no new messages to pass from Corzine's companions to Captain Morse, and the doctor secured by the rich Bridgebane family had delivered potions and bleedings to all, as promised. Corzine was spending most of his days sleeping, but he was not dead, and it was Christmas Eve day. The holly bits were tied with pine branches and set on the sills of the street facing windows. Glass bowls of red berries were set on small tables in the drawing room, library, and the front parlor. Madam had 2 soldiers hang a ball of mistletoe in the front hall. This provided great merriment amongst the men and some blushing on the part of their wives. I had never seen a house decorated with tree branches to celebrate the birth of the baby Jesus, but it did pretty up the place. The best was when Madam told us to hang dried rosemary throughout. That cut right through the lingering stench of boots and belchings. In keeping with tradition, I was to have Christmas Day free from work. I pondered hard on what I should do with so many hours for myself. Christmas at home had meant eating Mama's bread pudding with maple syrup and nutmeg, and reading the Gospel of Matthew out loud whilst Ruth played in Mama's lap. I was miles away from celebrating like that. I tried to bury the remembering, but it kept floating to the top of my mind like a cork in a stormy sea, and foolish tears spilled over. I finally decided to treat myself to a long stroll through all of New York, from the waterfront north to Chambers Street, and a side-to-side wander from the East River to the North River, which some had taken to call in the Hudson. For one day my legs would be my own, not at the beck and call of others. On Christmas morning, Lady Seymour presented me with a new pair of black leather shoes that did not pinch any of my toes. Madam gave the soldier wives each a coin. She gave me nothing. When we returned home from the service at St. Paul's Chapel, Madam explained that my day off would begin as soon as I had finished serving the midday meal. Sarah had cooked it in advance, a sirloin of beef, smoked ham, onion pie, and a plum pudding for dessert. Master and Madam both filled up on the onion pie and hardly touched the fresh baked bread. Lady Seymour ate enough for an undersized mouse. I ate porridge and beef for my Christmas dinner, a right curious combination, but a tasty one. As I cleared away the table, Madam informed me that my day off would begin after I brought in wood and washed up the dishes. Lady Seymour fired off a cannon blast of a glare at her, but Madam pretended not to notice, and the master kept his face planted in his newspaper. There had been heat rising between the 2 women for days. Madam was prepared to row the aunt to Charleston to get rid of her. After the meal, the master went to order the carriage to take them to some admiral's house for eggnog. Lady Seymour said she was going to rest and required nothing of me. As the lady limped to her chamber and the master disappeared down the stairs, I picked up the tray that held the last of the dishes. Madam poured herself another cup of tea. "One moment, girl," she said. I paused. "Yes, ma'am." Madam said nothing while she stirred the sugar into her tea. She sipped, wrinkled her nose, added another spoonful, stirred, then sipped again. She set the teacup in the saucer and examined the walnut tarts on the plate before her. I stood like a statue holding the tray. Would she take away the rest of my day? Force me to wash the table linens or starch the master's shirts? Madam gave her tea another stir.
You have been idling around the Bridewell prison.
My heart stopped. She picked up a tart, considered its scorched bottom, and returned it to the plate.
My husband's aunt says that you visit the prison at her direction, bringing table scraps not good enough for pigs. She declared that forgiving and caring for the enemy is doing the Lord's work.
My heart started up again, racing so fast I thought it might escape my body.
Madam picked up a second tart and scratched off the scorched bits with her knife before taking a bite. She chewed, sipped more tea, and swallowed.
My husband's aunt is a blithering idiot who has completely lost her wits. You should have told me of her requests at once.
She finally looked at me, her eyes cold as frozen coins.
You represent this house, girl. Your visits could put us under suspicion of having rebel tendencies. I will not be ruined by you, be it through innocence, as Aunt proclaims, or insolence, which I suspect. I forbid you to go to the prison.
My arm shook from the weight of the tray as well as her words. She could do anything. Order me to the stocks, another Brandon, or a public whipping of hundreds of lashes. She could beat me herself. She could sell me as she had done Ruth. Only place me with the cruelest master who'd work me to death in days. A pearl of sweat trickled down my cheek.
Madam finished the tart and wiped the corners of her mouth with her fingertip.
While my husband's aunt lives here, my hands are tied.
She reached for another tart.
But she'll soon be gone, one way or another, and Elihu will be in England.
She popped the entire tart into her mouth, chewed, then licked her fingers.
That is the day you should fear, girl.
After the carriage left, and dishes were washed and Lady Seymour was sound asleep, I started my free day, still trembling from Madam's threat. How could I get word to Corzin that I couldn't bring food any longer? Would Dibdin let him starve if I stopped being his messenger? What if I ignored Madam's rule and continued to visit the Bridewell? I walked block after block pondering. I walked past the ropeworks and the brewery, to the orchards on the east side, silent under the snow. I walked past houses that had letters G.R., George Rex carved into the front door, property stolen in the name of the king. Like Madam had carved her letters into my soul, burned the mark into my skin. She can do anything. I can do nothing. The ashes of sadness and the buzzing bees of my melancholy all spun a storm inside of me. And I walked and walked until my new shoes rubbed blisters all over my feet and the blisters popped. I took off the shoes and walked in the snow. Once my feet were frozen enough, the blisters didn't hurt. As the sun ran for the west, rowdy songs started up in the taverns and groggeries. I found myself on the shore of the North River, just above the Battery. Empty rowboats were tied up to a wharf. As the tide pulled out to the ocean, they bobbed and bumped against each other. A few lights twinkled across the water in faraway New Jersey. I thought of all the ancestors waiting at the water's edge for their stolen children to come home. Waiting and waiting and waiting. A thought surfaced through my ashes. She cannot chain my soul. Yes, she could hurt me. She'd already done so. But what was one more beating, a flogging even? I would bleed or not, scar or not, live or not. But she could no longer harm Ruth, and she could not hurt my soul. Not unless I gave it to her. This was a new notion to me. And a curious one. A group of soldiers singing loud as they could swayed down the street, very muddy in drink. I hid in the shadows until they were gone, then headed back to Wall Street. I passed several houses filled with Christmas carols, joy to the world, and I saw three ships and the first Noel. A fat candle glowed on a parlor windowsill of a house on a corner, set there to guide someone home. The Locktons and Lady Seymour were all retired for the night by the time I returned. The house was still empty of soldiers and their wives. I built up the fire in the hearth, set my shoes and damp stockings to dry in front of it, and rubbed a calendula salve on my blisters. Christmas, Mama's voice reminded. Keep Christmas. For the second time on the very same day, tears threatened. I rubbed them away and vowed not to cry again,
'Twas a nuisance. I found myself studying the loaf of bread on the table. A sharp knife showed up in my hand, and the loaf was soon cut into fat slices. A chipped crockery bowl appeared from the pantry, alongside the butter and eggs and milk and the sugar loaf and the nutmeg grater and the small amber flask. I baked me a maple syrup bread pudding in the Rhode Island style. While it cooked, I cleaned myself up good and proper. I thought about stealing a piece of Madame's rose-scented soap, but that would have made me smell like her. I prefer to smell like strong lye. I washed my arms and legs and the back of my neck and my ears and my face, and I dried myself with a soft, clean rag. I frowned as I stepped back into my clothes. I'd grown some, and they didn't fit proper. I'd let out the seams of the bodice as much as I could and taken out the hem of the skirt. Much more growing, and I'd look a right scandal. But I wouldn't think on that now. I was trying to make a Christmas. I pulled on my dry stockings and stepped into my new shoes. Even though they rubbed fierce on the pop blisters, I put the bowl of bread pudding into a basket, tied on my cloak, and wound up my hands in rags to keep the frost from biting. I walked out the back door. It was not yet midnight, so in truth, 'twas still the day I could call my own. I set my path westward to the burnt-over district, to Canvas Town. The line where September's fire had stopped was sharp-cut. First a house with no damage, next a house still bearing black streaks of soot and smoke, then a field of ruin, with makeshift hovels crafted from tent, brick, and scorched timbers. Rats nibbled on frozen garbage heaps. The smell of the fire still lingered, tainted with the smell of filth and decay. But in the bleakness, there were spots of hope. A wreath was stuck on the front of a tent. Children's clothes hung from a clothesline, stiff with ice, but still sweet-looking. A butter churn stood watch over a neat stack of fresh split wood. Smoke swirled slow from the top of a chimney, dipped at the roof line, then rose up to the stars. I lifted my face to the sky, and for the first time in much too long, I prayed. I prayed as hard as I could, without words or shapes or fancy talking. I just prayed. When I was done, I felt cleaner than I had after my bath. I walked on until I found a hut built against a lone brick wall. From inside came sounds of a family. The papa's low rumble, the mama's bright laugh, and giggling children who had been allowed to stay up much too late and who did not want to fall asleep. I greeted them through the piece of canvas that served as their front door. The hovel fell silent. Then the canvas was pushed aside, and the father stepped out, a musket in his hand. His wife came right behind him, though he told her to stay inside. It took some convincing to explain my mission, but I spoke polite and firm and held out the bread pudding, and the children snuck out in their nightclothes and just about dove into the bowl. The mother took the basket and said, "Thank you," and then "Thank you again," and then "Thank you most, most kindly," and they went back inside. I hummed a carol as I walked away, finally feeling at peace. Chapter 39. Thursday, December 26th through Tuesday, December 31st, 1776. In the army at present, merit is measured only by rank. Those who are high in rank are clever fellows. The low are small folks, and those who have none at all, like us, are poor devils. We are nobodies. We have nothing. Samuel Tenney, writing to his friend Peter Turner about his frustration with the privileges of officers. 2 days later, Sarah had me go with her to the fish market. Her back was hurting her fierce, and I was to carry the cod and halibut needed for a fish chowder. The market was crowded with folk whose cupboards had been cleaned out by the Christmas feasting, and Sarah muttered rude things. Her growing discomfort had put her in a constant temper. The cod was easy enough to purchase, but stall after stall turned up no halibut. Sarah insisted that haddock or catfish would not do, so we marched on. The air was thick with the cries of the stall owners promising the juiciest fish, the freshest fish, and fish fit for the king himself. Before dawn, I had made the trip to the tea water pump, but I had dared not visit the prison or Captain Morse's tavern. I was still confuddled about what to do. My thoughts wandered. I did not realize that Sarah had moved ahead of me in the crowd until a great shout went up. An oyster seller's cart had overturned in front of the carp stall, and the two men were hollering at each other. The crowd halted, and I had no place to turn. Sarah's white cloth cap bobbed away in the distance as I looked for a path out of the crowd,
but bodies pushed in front from all sides to watch the two men arguing. When a hand grabbed my arm, I gasped.
"Apologies, Jess Sal,"
Captain Moore said as he released me. His eyes were tired, but his cheeks were flushed. My mouth gaped open like that of a fish breathing its last. I shook my head. He couldn't talk to me in view of all. There was no mistaking what he was dressed in that brown and white coat. I turned first one way, then the other, but bodies were packed around me tight as could be. Morse kept his eyes on the arguing men, but leaned in his face close enough to mine that I could hear him whisper, "We must talk." Sarah had realized I was no longer with her. Her cap stopped, then slowly started back toward us. Her husband was a British gunner. "If she saw me talking to a rebel officer, go away," I muttered. "I have news for my men." The oyster seller picked up a carp and shook it in the other man's face. The crowd laughed. Sarah plowed toward me. "I beg you," Morse whispered. "Please." Soldiers appeared on the edge of the crowd to restore order. "Come up to the tavern." "Yes, yes," I told the captain. "I'll come this afternoon. Now go away." The crowd melted under the eyes of the armed soldiers. The carp seller was explaining the ruckus to a sergeant while the oyster seller reloaded his cart. Sarah kicked oysters out of her way as she approached. "Where in the name of all that's holy did you get to?" she asked. "I was trapped in the crowd," I said. "I called, but you could not hear me." She grunted and handed me a small fish with glassy eyes. "This will have to do. Halibut is rare as hen's teeth today." I settled it in the basket atop the fat cod and followed Sarah as she headed away from the market. We walked in silence for a few blocks, her concentrating on her huffing and puffing, me trying to figure if I dared go up to the tavern. The sky promised more snow. How long would Dibden wait before reclaiming Corson's hat and blanket? We crossed the street. "Miss Sarah, ma'am," I asked, sweet as honey.
"What is it?"
I chose my words with care. "Has Madam Lockton said anything about me and your hearing?" She tilted her head a bit as she looked at me.
"Aye, this morn, matter of fact. Said you wasn't allowed to go to that blasted water pump. Said I should send one of the other girls, even though the sun not be up at that time of day, even though the streets be covered in ice."
Sarah reached for my elbow as we trod upon a slick patch of cobblestones. "But I like getting out," I said, "and I don't mind the chore." We reached a stretch where ashes had been thrown into the ice and the going was safer.
"I don't answer to her," Sarah said as she released my arm. "I answer to the king's army. I'd be right pleased if you kept fetching the water. Makes my life easier."
She stopped and put her hands on her back, breathing heavily. Her baby belly was so big she could have loaded it in a wheelbarrow and pushed it in front of her. She caught me studying her and gave a quick smile. "The babe will come soon," she said.
"It'll be a joyous day," I said. "I'll keep getting the water, but
what?
Could you please not tell Madam?"
Sarah stretched to one side and winced. "What you don't know won't hurt her. It's not like she's up at that hour anyways." After the midday meal, I contrived to overturn the pitcher that held the tea water, dumping it on the floor.
"Clumsy dolt," Hannah scolded as I knelt to clean the floor with rags.
"Don't be looking at me to trudge up there and get more for her high mightiness," Mary said from her chair by the window. She squinted and sewed another stitch. "I've got to hem these breeches before the light fades."
"I'll run up and fetch it," I said. "Double time, I promise."
Sarah gave me a good hard stare, sensing she did not have the entire picture before her.
"It's your neck," she finally said. "Mind she don't see you leave."
I near ran up to the Golden Hill Tavern, my raw blisters hurting with every step. Captain Morse was idling on the porch, smoking a pipe. He disappeared inside when he saw me and was waiting in the alley when I reached it.
"Here."
He handed me a loaf of bread.
"You made me come up here for this?" I asked. "Take it to Dibden," he said, fighting a smile. "There's a note baked inside."
"A note?"
"It contains wondrous news."
He looked ready to jump out of his skin.
"Washington has beaten them."
"Sir?"
He clenched his fists and unclenched them. "On Christmas night, the general led a surprise attack on Trenton. He beat the Hessians, killed a handful, and took more than 900 prisoners."
"Are you sure?"
"I thought someone told him a falsehood.
The British officers I knew were confident the American army was falling apart. Positively, he said with a grin. But won't that make the British mad? I asked.
I truly hope so. I hope the king is so upset he jumps up and down on his crown. This war is not over, not by a long shot.
I handed the bread back. I'll tell them the news, but I cannot pass a note. That could land me in jail. He shoved the loaf back at me.
You are a serving girl, delivering a tavern loaf to the starving prisoners. You don't know about the note.
But why is it necessary?
The men need to see my signature to know this is truth. They have endured so much, Sal. Don't deprive them of this chance to celebrate. It will strengthen their spirits.
I pulled up the hood of my cloak to hide my face as I approached the prison. The commons was filled with drilling soldiers, much more than usual. The officers barked commands with urgency. The men marched grim-faced, swords flapping against their legs, rifles bouncing on their shoulders. Perhaps the captain's news was indeed the truth. I hurried behind the building to the right window. I stood on tiptoe and squished the loaf through the bars. Dibden's face appeared at the window.
There's a note inside, I whispered. Tear into it carefully.
I ran away before he could answer, willing my feet to move faster. I had walked a block south when an enormous roar erupted from the prison. Hundreds of throats cheering, hooting, hollering. Hundreds of hands clapping and feet stomping with joy. The noise was such that folks stopped what they were doing and ran out of doors to stare. The news spread from the prison as fast as it had spread from cell to cell. The rebels had attacked instead of running. The rebels had advanced instead of retreating. The rebels had won a battle. Folks could scarce credit it. Chapter 40. Wednesday, January 1st, through Tuesday, January 7th, 1777. It is with much concern that I am to inform your lordship the unfortunate and untimely defeat at Trenton has thrown us further back than was at first apprehended from the great encouragement given to the rebels. British General William Howe, writing to Lord George Germain, Secretary of State for American Colonies after the American victory at Trenton. Just after the New Year came word of another shocking victory for the rebels, this one at Princeton in New Jersey. Washington's troops chased the British from the battlefield, killed a passel of them, and took a couple of hundred prisoners. Folks could scarce credit this, neither. Colonel Hawkins let out a roar in the study when the news was delivered and hit the unfortunate messenger on the head with a rolled-up map. Then he called for his horse and galloped off to headquarters. Within a day, the British promised boiled peas and rice with butter twice a week for their American prisoners, but they still did not allow fires in the Bridewell cells. The men had to eat their meat raw. Their chamber pots froze solid at night. The master's trip to London was moved up so that he could deliver news of the setbacks to the Parliament and King. Madam had finally accommodated herself to the notion of his voyage and had found a way to turn it to her advantage. Whilst we prepared Lockton's clothes for the journey, she wrote out long lists of items she wanted him to buy in England. I kept to the kitchen and cellar and woodpile when she was awake, but made my trips up island each day before dawn, looking over my shoulder at every sound, choosing a different path daily. The constant worry ate a hole in my belly. Corzin was stronger and told me not to fret, for he was not coughing up blood and his bowels were in fine working order, but he always asked me to come back on the morrow. The day of the master's departure, I roused myself extra early on account of I feared Madam might do the same. I deposited stale rolls and burnt hunks of pork on the windowsill of Corzin's cell, then crossed the commons on my way to the pump. There were a few folk out on their own early morning errands, all bundled in cloaks and blanket coats and shawls and scarves wrapped high.
"You there!" a loud voice called out.
Everyone stopped to look.
"You there, girl!"
"Oh, no." A British soldier hurried toward me. I relaxed some when I saw his face. It was the mountain-sized guard who had let me visit Corzin's cell when he was first in prison, the one who liked to eat.
"Haven't seen you round," he said as he neared me.
I bobbed quickly. "The rules don't allow civilians in the cells." He lowered his rifle to the ground and eyed my bucket.
"True enough. What you bring him today?"
"Bread crust and burnt meat, sir." He wrinkled his nose.
"What about yesterday?"
"Yesterday was kidney pie and stale almond cake, sir." He shook his head and licked his lips.
"Sorry I missed that, I am.
Wouldn't hurt to drop off a bite now and then to one such as myself, would it?
No, sir, I answered. I shall remember that. He tilted his head to the side.
Your master ever hire you out?
'Twas common in those days for folks to hire out their slaves to make money.